loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the news of the day. First, House Speaker Paul Ryan met yesterday with senior officials of the United Arab Emirates, despite the fact that the UAE is running a torture program in Yemen's secret prisons. U.S. forces have interrogated detainees in the same facilities. Additionally, just today, the UN reported a mass drowning of at least 30 African refugees off the coast of Yemen. Next, the newly appointed police chief of Honduras, long supported by the U.S. military as helping prevent cocaine movement into the U.S., is implicated in a security report that shows that he helped a cartel move a truckload of cocaine. Then, Albuquerque has tried to criminalize homelessness with an ordinance passed in November 2017 that prohibits interactions between drivers and pedestrians who are on medians and freeway entrances, including panhandling. The New Mexico ACLU has filed a lawsuit against Albuquerque in federal court. And then, vast inequality is on the rise in the nation's capital as longtime residents are forced out, over-policed, and denied a decent education. What are the city's priorities, and what does it say about the state of the country? Finally, we look at the worst and most misleading headlines of the week. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to Paul Ryan and his trip to the United Arab Emirates. House Speaker Paul Ryan met yesterday with senior officials of the United Arab Emirates, despite the fact that the UAE is running a torture program in Yemen's secret prisons. U.S. forces have interrogated detainees in those same facilities. Additionally, just today, the UN reported a mass drowning of at least 30 African refugees off the coast of Yemen. We're joined from Chicago by Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Welcome, Kathy.
Hello, Brian and John. Thank you for inviting me to your show.
Kathy, this is an issue that I think 99% of Americans probably either don't know about or are ignoring. The UAE, United Arab Emirates, is a very close U.S. ally in the Middle East. The UAE government advertises regularly on American television, come to Dubai, come to Abu Dhabi, great vacation spots, you can ski indoors in the summer, etc. But the reality is something that's far uglier. Secret prisons in Yemen, bombing raids, human rights abuses. Tell our listeners what's really happening in Yemen.
Well, I think that the terror that people face when they can't feed their children is almost beyond our imagining. The terror that people face when, for instance, as happened with the very unfortunate situation of people who fled from Ethiopia, from Somalia, because conditions there were so terrible, and they hoped maybe they'd find work, they'd find some kind of security. They got to Yemen and discovered that that was a very bad idea. And so smugglers said that they would get those people back to Djibouti, and then maybe they could migrate elsewhere. But on the waters, apparently there was some kind of effort to extort even more money. The smugglers threatening the people on the boat. There was some. There were stories of gunfire on that boat. The boat capsized. 30 people drowned. That's terrifying. And, you know, that kind of terror, that horrid ending of life, just simply doesn't enter into the picture when you see Paul Ryan and the congressional delegation seated in a very secure spot in Abu Dhabi, or, they'll be moving on to sit in secure spots with the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia and the UAE have been regularly bombing civilian places in Yemen, targeting, it would seem, civilians. Is there no mention? I mean, the United States sold the THAAD missile system to the United Arab Emirates. We've sold billions of dollars worth of weapons to Saudi Arabia. We've helped both countries with mid-air jet refueling so that they can carry out these bombing sorties. And yet the only kind of security that the people in the United States are supposed to imagine is the security for United States economic benefits and war profiteering.
That's the sad truth of this, Brian, isn't it? I mean, the UAE, if you look at, I mean, just look at a map. The UAE has no real conflict with Yemen. I mean, they sort of, I think, have come to the conclusion that the Houthis are somehow an Iranian proxy, and this is their way of indirectly fighting the Iranians. But historically, the UAE and Yemen have had close relations. In fact, there are hundreds of thousands of Yemeni citizens who are working in the UAE, mostly in construction. So this decision by the UAE government to indiscriminately bomb civilian facilities in Yemen, including water purification plants, towns and villages, it really makes no geopolitical sense, does it?
Perhaps not for the UAE per se, but again, if you look at and think of the UAE as part of a network of American, of an extension of American power vis-a-vis a collection of states, a network of states, including Saudi Arabia, including Yemen. They have their own interests, of course. They pursue their own agenda, but ultimately seen as an expansion or an extension of American power. I'm looking at an AP story, Kathy Kelly. In Yemen's secret prisons, UAE tortures and U.S. interrogates. And I want to read for our audience real quickly two or three sentences that open this article. Hundreds of men swept up in the hunt for Al-Qaeda militants have disappeared into a secret network of prisons in southern Yemen, where abuse is routine and torture extreme, including the grill, in which the victim is tied to a spit like a roast and spun in a circle of fire, an Associated Press investigation has found. Senior American defense officials acknowledged Wednesday that U.S. forces have been involved in interrogations of detainees in Yemen, but denied any participation in or knowledge of human rights abuses. I mean, this is not credible. I mean, if the AP knows this, everybody knows it. Anyway, the American government is completely complicit in this. It's an amazing crime against humanity. Go ahead, Kathy.
Well, and also 2,000 missing people have been sought by their families, and the families have regular demonstrations, even though it must be extremely dangerous to speak up or to try to protest because you could become a captive. You could be sent to one of these terrible prisons. And of course, once those kinds of prisons get the green light, and let's face it, Guantanamo gives the big green light. The United States has operated prisons that have tortured people horribly. There are other groups within Yemen that also take captives, and so the terror that people face when they go into one of those horrible prisons is something that should be on the United States mainstream media coverage regularly, because the United States, as you mentioned, has had interrogations going on, and they have to be linked. And this isn't only the AP reporter. The Human Rights Watch corroborated that report. Amnesty International corroborated that report. So these are realities that, of course, generate terrible insecurity and fear. No wonder people are trying to flee and to go elsewhere or become internally displaced. And if Paul Ryan believes that it's going to create security for him to just sort of completely avoid any mention of humanitarian suffering in a country like Yemen while the United States is exacerbating that war, is, I think, treacherous. You know, the UN had put out a report called Dangerous Crossings, and it's a needed report. It's trying to say to people, don't let yourself get involved with a smuggler to get onto one of these totally insecure boats and possibly risk your life crossing the seas, or in the case of these very, very unfortunate people whose boat capsized while apparently the smugglers were trying to extort more money from them. Dangerous Crossings is a good title for that report. But I think Paul Ryan, reading a delegation of U.S. Congress people to meet with UAE representatives and the royalty, and now in Riyadh with Mohammed bin Salman, who has orchestrated that war. It's his war. He says the longer it lasts, the better it is from their perspective in Saudi Arabia. This is a dangerous crossing as well. It endangers the lives of so many people.
I'd like to point out also that we've got an administration here in the United States where the president said publicly during the campaign that he would like to bring back waterboarding and, quote, a hell of a lot worse. He apparently has been restrained by some of the generals with whom he has surrounded
restraint,
himself.
You mean in his language?
In his language.
Yeah.
Not in his behavior, I don't believe. But I'm looking at that same AP report that you quoted, and it says here, several U.S. defense officials, speaking on condition of anonymity to discuss the topic, told AP that American forces do participate in interrogations of detainees at locations in Yemen, provide questions for others to ask, and receive transcripts of interrogations from Emirati allies. They said U.S. senior military leaders were aware of allegations of torture at the prisons in Yemen, looked into them, and here's the operative remainder of the sentence, but were satisfied that there had not been any abuse when U.S. forces were present. I can tell you from my many years in the CIA that that's what we've always done. You capture a prisoner, you turn him over to an ally, and you say, we want you to interrogate him. Don't torture him, wink, wink. And when you're all done with him, send us a transcript of the interrogation. So that way the U.S. gets the so-called intelligence, and they don't have to worry about these human rights abuses and these allegations of torture. This is nothing new. This is exactly what the United Nations has banned, expressly banned, and the United States is still participating in it. Kathy, we've got about a minute and a half left. Go right ahead.
Well, let's also keep in mind that Saudi pilots are being trained in Australia, that a former Australian general, Michael Hindmarsh, is now coordinating the Yemeni presidential, the United Arab Emirates Presidential Guard, a group of military special operations forces. And so there's a collusion of people in the military-industrial complex transnationally that I believe is instigating increasing and unbearable levels of terror amongst people who are hungry, people who are displaced, and people who are trying desperately to feed themselves and their families.
Well, we'd like to thank Kathy Kelly. She joined us from Chicago. Kathy is the co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Thanks for joining us and telling us about this important issue. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
As protests continue to rage in Honduras against the inauguration of U.S. ally Juan Orlando Hernandez, a report has emerged that the newly appointed police chief of Honduras, long supported by the U.S. military for helping prevent cocaine movement into the U.S., is now implicated in a security report that shows he helped a cartel move a truckload of cocaine. We're joined from Chicago by Vicky Cervantes. She is the North America coordinator of the Honduras Solidarity Network. Welcome to the show, Vicky.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Vicky, we see this in this report in different news outlets across the country here today. What are we supposed to make of this?
Well, I think what we should make of it is the fact that Juan Orlando Hernandez and the National Party, which is his political party, are totally implicated in and friendly to the narcotics trafficker, despite his cultivated reputation by the U.S. government as being a crime fighter and an ally in the war on drugs.
You know, I should note, too, that this security report that is being cited by the Associated Press as the source, this is a classified document. It's unclear if it's a Honduran document or an American one, but it's certainly a secret security document. So I don't know. That would lead me to believe that there's something to this. And the report goes on to say that the street value of this cocaine is about $20 million. We're talking about serious drugs here.
That's correct. And it was a secret document. And from what I've read from the AP, which are the people who obtained it, it also included that they had sources who told them about notations in the personnel file and in the classified personnel file of Aguilar, the new national police chief. So it seems very credible to me.
I want to quote for a second from this Associated Press report. It says, an ex-member of the national police with knowledge of the investigation confirmed officials found that Aguilar and other top officials conspired to cover up the incident and that a high-ranking officer protecting the cocaine was later put on leave before becoming a sitting judge. Three other current and former high-ranking Honduran security and police officials confirmed elements of the report. They spoke on condition of anonymity for fear of violent reprisals. It's not like nobody knew this story. It seems like a lot of people knew that this was happening.
That's correct. And it's also interesting to note that not only Aguilar was involved in this, but his new number two in the national police, Orbin Gal Maldonado, was also involved in the meetings. And the guy who's now been, now Juan Orlando has made the Inspector General of the National Police, Orlin Cerrato Cruz, was also involved in these meetings and these discussions with the narcotics traffickers.
It shouldn't be that big of a surprise to us, John.
No.
And of course, he's in the military in Honduras, and the U.S. is now backing this as the legitimate government, even though it's pretty clear that there was election fraud. I mean, it seems so by all the available evidence. The U.S. went way out on the limb. And earlier, the U.S. government under the Obama administration, when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, supported the 2009 military coup that overthrew the elected government. We have a long history, though, where the U.S. government, either the Pentagon or the CIA, has been involved because they're supporting military dictators or military covert operations in different parts of the world that need financing. So there's this toxic combination of personal enrichment and financing of covert operations. We saw with the CIA in the Golden Triangle in Southeast Asia. I mean, that there's no dispute about that, I don't think. I think that's now public record that the CIA or sectors of the CIA were involved in supporting drug trafficking or allowing it to go take place under their nose.
And the same thing happened in Afghanistan.
Same thing in Afghanistan. And then we had Nicaragua, the very important story about what happened during the Reagan years with the Contras and
right.
The need to overcome the absence of once Congress cut off money to the Contras and the intelligence agencies that were backing them were looking for other means of financing. There was a lot of stories about this, a lot of controversy about how this happened. This might be the tip of the iceberg, in fact. It's kind of a shocking story, but not a new story. Go ahead, Vicky.
Yeah, no, I think that's very true. And in the case of Honduras, I think it's another good example of the incredible hypocrisy of the U.S. on the whole war on drugs, that after the coup d'etat in 2009, the narcotics traffic through Honduras increased dramatically. It had existed before, but it increased dramatically. The U.S., since about 2013, I think, has given more than $30 million in aid, including security aid. They've supported the militarization, the creation of all sorts of new heavily armed police units, including the military police that we're seeing in the streets now. And what we've gotten from it is not an end to any narcotics traffic, certainly not an end to any narcotics coming into the U.S. And in Honduras, incredible insecurity, the highest murder rate in the world outside of war zones, increased migration, corruption, and now we're seeing all these same military units, the weapons, the tear gas, the bullets, the tanks, the military police are part of a war that's been declared on the people of Honduras by Juan Orlando Hernandez, and the U.S. is supporting it.
Talk about the fight back against the coup. There's the strike, of course. Tell our audience here in Washington, D.C. and around the country, what's going on with the resistance to this?
Sure. I was in Honduras for 3 weeks at the time of the election, and so I saw the outbreak of the resistance when it became so clear that the election results were being tinkered with and were fraudulent. And what happened was people started going to the streets in the thousands, peacefully, rowdy, but peacefully, burning tires, blocking intersections, or just running around with their flags. And after about one day, about 24 hours, they were started to be attacked by the military police and the national police, heavy use of tear gas. And then several days later, a curfew was implemented and the military police started using live bullets and picking off protesters. In the last week, there's been a national, I would call it a civic strike, because it's broader than a work strike. There's a national civic strike. People have been holding mass demonstrations about two or three times a week. And then every day of the week, everywhere in the country, there are groups sort of roving protests, blocking streets, blocking major highways, because it's a very rural country, so a lot of things happen out on the highways. And they have been attacked by the militarization in the country right now is greater than at any time ever, greater than in 2009 during the coup. There are jeeps with machine guns mounted on them in the smallest towns. There are police everywhere. And I think we are now up to more than 40 people killed by the military police, mostly. We have over a thousand have been arrested, and out of those, there's probably 200 with serious charges placed against them. And this includes Edwin Robles Espinal, a very well-known activist who just got arrested this week, and is they're charging him with very serious crimes over some damage that was done to a building in Tegucigalpa during a protest, but there's no evidence that any protesters actually did the damage. So the situation really, it looks like a war. It really looks like a war, but only one side is armed.
Yeah, and that one side that's armed, they, meaning the military, they were trained by the American military. They were trained at the so-called School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia. Romeo Vasquez, the general who led the military coup in Honduras against President Manuel Zelaya in 2009, yes, he received his training at the U.S. School of the Americas. And the School of Americas has trained more than 60,000 soldiers all over Latin America and officers, many of whom returned home and committed human rights abuses, torture, extrajudicial executions, massacres. I mean, so what when we look at Honduras and we notice that the American government, the Trump administration, isn't bothered by the new national police chief actually being a drug runner, it's not that surprising, because this is the pattern. This is the dominant pattern.
Yeah, this is not something that you would look at and say, oh my gosh, that can't possibly be true, because we know there's this history on both sides, the Hondurans and the United States. And, you know, when you go all these generations without being able to play by the rules and to respect democracy and democratic values, this is what you end up with.
We're out of time. We've been joined from Chicago by Vicky Cervantes. She is the North American coordinator of the Honduras Solidarity Network. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Albuquerque has tried to criminalize homelessness with an ordinance passed in November 2017 that prohibits interactions between drivers and pedestrians who are on medians and freeway entrances, including panhandlers. The New Mexico ACLU has filed a lawsuit against Albuquerque in federal court. We're joined by Marissa Sanchez from Albuquerque, New Mexico. She's an activist with Act Now to Stop War and End Racism, and she's a plaintiff in the case. Marissa, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I truly appreciate it.
Marissa, so let me ask you a basic question. Does this stretch beyond people who are just, standing on medians? Does this include people who are homeless and are hungry? Can I still walk up to a homeless person and give him money or something to eat?
Sure. So the ordinance is specifically targeting panhandling and the interaction between vehicles and pedestrians. We can still hand something to someone on the street, but the ordinance is written in such a broad way that it does make it illegal to stand in the streets or on sidewalks and medians. So in this way, the police will be able to, for basically trespassing, clear people from these areas.
And Marissa, you're a plaintiff. You're not on the lawsuit as a homeless person. You have a job, you have an apartment, presumably. You're on the lawsuit because there's a First Amendment issue, and you're part of the anti-war movement, part of the Answer Coalition, Act Now to Stop War and End Racism. What's the First Amendment implications here?
Sure. So because the way that the ordinance is written and the fact that we're not able to stand in the streets, on sidewalks and medians, especially it targets busy intersections and the exit and off-ramps of freeways, this does impact political free speech, which is why I'm a plaintiff on the lawsuit. It makes it illegal for me to be able to protest in these spaces, which is, it's very important that we're able to access these areas, because as we know, the media doesn't cover, you know, anti-war messaging like the type that Answer Coalition is putting out. So it's absolutely essential that activists and organizers be able to hit the streets and access these spaces with the anti-war messaging that we're presenting, because people feel very politically isolated, especially whenever the war drums are beating and the major media is really only presenting the ideas of, you know, politicians who are for war and intervention. When people are able to drive down the street and see banners and slogans and placards and see that there is an anti-war movement here in the United States, it's very encouraging for them. Not being able to access these spaces really impacts our ability to distribute this information that's essential to get to people.
I'm looking at a report on the website of KRQE News, Channel 13 in Albuquerque, and it does nothing except confuse me a little more. It's quoting the mayor of Albuquerque, R.J. Berry, as saying, if you hand $5 out of your window to a panhandler today, that panhandler can go down to a fast food restaurant and buy a hamburger and fries. Okay, that sounds perfectly reasonable. That's why you would hand money to a panhandler. Instead, however, the city wants people to donate money to the United Way, and the group will then use the money to feed the hungry and provide shelter for the homeless and help the mentally ill. But we know about the United Way, and this is exactly why I don't give money to the United Way, because the head of the United Way makes well over $1 million a year in salary. He flies private jets when he goes from point A to point B. And to me, the United Way is a way for a lot of people to get rich, and not enough money filters down to the poor. It's kind of like trickle-down economics. It's a great idea. It just doesn't work.
And just think about what really happens for all of us who are on the street. We see a homeless person. The person is obviously in need. The person asks for money, as people standing on a medium strip do. They do here in the Washington, D.C. metro area. And you make a decision right then and there. Oh, goodness, it's so cold out. I'm going to give that person $1 or $5 or whatever you're going to give them. Nobody's going to see a homeless person on the street and then go home and say, hey, let me look up the United Way website.
Exactly.
I mean, it's just exactly. So ludicrous. What the city is really doing is trying to make the homeless go away, make them become invisible,
exactly,
make them
right.
illegal. And then it has to cover its tracks by saying, oh, but by the way, if you want to make a donation to them, you can do it through the United Way. But really, it's sanitizing Albuquerque from the reality that there are homeless people, and there
that's
are
right.
homeless people because rents are too high and wages are too low. Go
that's
ahead,
right.
Marissa.
Yeah, that's exactly how we're interpreting the ordinance. It is an attempt to push poverty out of sight, but of course, poverty can never be out of mind for those who are experiencing it. And the other aspect to this is here in Albuquerque, the ordinance is trying to be passed as a public safety ordinance. They're saying it's not about panhandling, it's about safety and people being, you know, in these busy intersections or close to these busy on and off ramps. And that's also somehow dangerous to reach out your window and hand someone that $5. But at the same time that they're trying to pass this ordinance under the guise of public safety, they have built a Albuquerque Rapid Transit, which is literally a series of 9 miles worth of bus stops that is down the central corridor of Albuquerque, the historic Route 66, and the bus stops are literally in the median. They are built in the middle of the street. So they're attempting to say that this has something to do with public safety, but they have built what has cost $130 million worth of bus stops in the middle of the road. So it's very ironic and confusing. If they care so much about people not being in the street, in the road, why did they build the art project, the Albuquerque Rapid Transit, down the middle of the central corridor here in Albuquerque?
I don't see how the plaintiffs lose this case, John, because
no,
obviously this statute
absolutely.
Is so broad. It's designed to, as Marissa said, to make the poor become invisible. But in so doing, it bans anti-war groups or civil liberties groups or anti-police brutality groups from being there and holding up banners and signs. And as Marissa said, if you're not getting mainstream corporate-owned media coverage, you have to be in the street. I mean, that's the only place you can see it. And then you have the city itself filling up these same spaces for bus shelters. I mean, it's obviously not true what their argument.
I have to give Marissa credit, Marissa and her group credit, because when I see this news, I see it in very narrow terms as an attempt to hide the homeless and to push them off to the side. If you can't panhandle at an intersection, for example, which is frankly where most people do their panhandling, well, you're going to have to go somewhere else where there are fewer people and you're not going to be able to make it. And face it, most people, some people buy drugs with money, sure, with the money that they panhandle for, but most people need it for food. If they have a little bit of extra money, they might even be able to spend a night in a little SRO hotel or something like that. It's for the basics. I want to give Marissa credit because she's exactly right that this is a First Amendment issue. This is a freedom of speech and freedom of expression issue. It's not just the homeless. It's much bigger than that. And I have to agree with you, Brian, that with that in mind, this looks like a case that's impossible to lose.
Marissa, we have about 90 seconds left. Go ahead. You get the last word.
Yeah, I just want to say that right now under the ordinance, people can face up to $500 in fines and 90 days in jail, which is, as we were saying, with this being a First Amendment issue, something that is really scary. I am a worker and I cannot afford to pay these types of fines or to spend time in jail. I have bills to pay. And as John was saying, people that are panhandling here in Albuquerque are doing so to survive. Unemployment in Albuquerque is 5.5%. So people that are out on the streets asking for donations are literally doing this so that they can get that money for a hotel for the night or food in their stomach so that they don't die of exposure here. And passing this ordinance in November truly shows how little care the Albuquerque City Council has for poor people. They passed this bill right before the onset of winter.
You know, you would think, John, here we have government at the local level, state level, federal level. Everybody's upset about the fact that the homeless, not everybody, the government or business, upset about the homeless being visible. You know, there's another solution to the homeless other than driving them into the netherworld. And that would be to give people jobs.
Exactly.
To give people decent social programs and decent social services to make sure that you don't, I mean, panhandling is hard work.
Sure.
I mean, if you're standing out in a median strip waiting to get a quarter, because it's mostly not $5, it's mainly a quarter or 50 cents or a dollar, just to put food in your stomach, or you see a lot of people panhandling here with their kids. They're not doing that because they're getting rich. They don't have jobs and they don't have housing. And between rent, first month rent, and security, unless you're making really good money, a lot of the, I would say most of the homeless at this point, probably most of the homeless in America are also working.
I think that's right. And a lot of the homeless who are not working because they're mentally ill. And again, there, they get no governmental services.
Okay, Marissa Sanchez, we said before you had the last word, but we had a little bit extra time. Now we have 20 more seconds. How do people learn about this website, about this lawsuit?
They can check the ACLU's website to read the actual legal complaint. And then I guess just to say that, yes, the lawsuit is truly about gentrifying Albuquerque and absolutely nothing to do with public safety.
We'd like to thank Marissa Sanchez from Albuquerque, New Mexico. She's an activist with Act Now to Stop War and End Racism, and she's a plaintiff in the case. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Vast inequality is on the rise in the nation's capital as longtime residents are forced out, over-policed, and denied a decent education. What are the city's priorities, and what does it say about the state of the country? We're joined in studio by Bob Schlehuber. He is a D.C. resident and the producer of Radio Sputnik's By Any Means Necessary, which you can listen to every weekday from 2 to 4 p.m. Bob, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Bob, this is unlike the D.C. government of the previous decade. It seems like we have a D.C. government in place now that is more responsive to developers and to bankers than at any point in the last 10 or even 20 years. What's going on with the D.C. government?
I think it's the people that they're bringing into the D.C. government from outside of the city, especially. I think with the school scandal, so much of the attention has been put on the students and the lack of attendance, as well as the teachers who've been forced to actually put passing grades on students that aren't attending class. I mean, it was staggering numbers. There was some 20% of students at Ballou High School in the district hadn't attended enough classes to even graduate, yet the high school promoted that they had 100% graduation rate. So all the attention and focus has been put on the students and these teachers. The teacher, the principal at Ballou's already been fired, and a lot of that direction and anger is put there. However, I want to highlight the new school chancellor, Antoine Wilson, who the district brought in from Oakland. And Oakland's currently having significant budget cuts within their school district. So the man pretty much wrecked the Oakland school district. And the staggering numbers, they had budgeted in the Oakland 2016-2017 budget for supervisors and administrators $10 million. They ended up spending $22 million. The
on
administrations. Consultants were budgeted at $21 million. Antoine Wilson, now chancellor of the D.C. schools, spent $28 million, $7 million over budget on consultants. Now, this is where the kicker is. Books and supplies, the district was supposed to spend $20 million. They only ended up spending $6.8 million. So the biggest cut dramatically underspent was on books and supplies. A lot of went to consultants. Well, where does Antoine Wilson learn this? He learns it through Eli Broad, who's a billionaire Los Angeles developer, one of these philanthropists that has a vision for America's children, has no involvement with education, wasn't a teacher himself, made a ton of money in real estate, and now all of a sudden he's training all of these different administrators across the country that have seen a financial motive in public schools, basically take public money and give it to the private market. The best way to have the best efficiency is the private market. Let's teach chancellors, let's teach superintendents how to basically go into districts, increase money to administrators, into the consultants, into the suits, into the fancy corporate board meeting types of lunches to discuss the future of children, cut all other costs. Supplies, books, any of the public good parts of public education, cut those. If the student doesn't have technology at home, they don't have a stable living condition at home, if they don't have food at home, that's not our space. Our space is to privatize and to make sure that these school districts run financially sound. And that's what we're seeing in the district, is there's so much attention on privatizing these schools into charter schools that these public schools that you're seeing this massive decrease in attendance doesn't have the basic resources to hire enough counselors, enough teachers, enough paras, enough mediators within the schools, enough of the arts programs, which we know over the last decades have been cut. So that's what you're seeing in the district, is this complete obfuscation of where the problem is that the city is bringing in high paid consultants and people that are just looking at budgets and not the students' outcomes to run the education.
Yeah, the Washington Post this week ran an article about Ballou High School and the principal there, saying that this pressure to pass students who really should not have been eligible to pass was so great that they ended up giving high school diplomas to kids who could not read the diploma once it was handed to them. And then, as you say, of all the people they could have brought in to, I'm using air quotes, save the DC schools, they brought in the one guy who probably sees his job as to wreck it.
Yeah, and it's quite disgusting, too. I mean, you mentioned Ballou High School. Less than half a mile from Ballou High School is the campus of St. Elizabeth's, which you mentioned in the lead in there. The city, along with their quasi-government agency of Vents DC, which most of its revenue comes from tourism, from the convention center, from RFK Stadium, that money is going to be used. That's taxpayer dollar. They try to play it off. We're not a government agency. This is from tourists out of the city. We're not increasing taxes on local residents, but that money could be used on schools or on different development projects around health or basic jobs or entrepreneurship for the young folks in the district. Instead, 0.6 miles from Ballou High School, they're building a brand new Washington Mystics WNBA basketball stadium. This basketball stadium was initially to cost $50 million. The cost has already skyrocketed to $65 million that Events DC, the quasi-government agency, you and other DC residents, taxpayer dollars will pay for a basketball stadium, along with an additional $100 million investment from the city on that campus over the next 5 years for more housing, for more entertainment, for more projects that aren't for the community.
Well, and you talk about housing, more housing. We're going to see housing at this new Mystic Stadium like we saw housing at the National Stadium. What it is it's gentrified housing that pushes poor people out of these neighborhoods where they've lived for generations, and it brings prices up And then the poor have nowhere to go.
And basically, those apartments just need to be offered at the market rate of affordable medium income, with the artificially inflated AMI, which is called in the district, which includes Chevy Chase and some of these surrounding suburbs. The average medium income in the district is around $110,000. Affordable that you can offer at market rate is some 60% of that. So all of a sudden, you're looking at, I don't know, $50,000. There's plenty of people in the district that make $50,000 that are living fine. They don't have families to support, but they have access to those apartments. So that's what you're looking at, of filling those affordable rates at this new basketball stadium. So the city over the next 5 years is going to spend $150 million on an economic development project, with no statistics from anywhere in the country that shows an economic development project like this is actually good for the community, actually creates additional tax revenues, creates any of the sustainable jobs they talk about, while at the same time, these students have anywhere near the resource, less than a half a mile away, and eventually they're going to pressure to close Ballou High School, close the other high schools, and just have nothing but charter schools east of the river, when that's already a proliferation of them.
Yeah.
Washington is a tale of two cities, because as you've pointed out, John Kiriakou, especially since 9/11, with the vast expansion of the military budget, the vast expansion of the intelligence budget, and all the attendant auxiliary intelligence businesses, this place has a lot of millionaires.
A lot.
A lot.
More per capita than anywhere else in America.
And then you had this city, a historically African-American city. About 75% African-American as late as the 1980s, is now majority not African-American. So these two things go together. The class and race issue go together. And I want to go back to the Ballou High School. Again, you look at the Washington Post headline about it. Some D.C. educators felt pressure to pass failing students union survey finds. So what's going to happen, as you were starting to allude to, Bob, the students will just not be able to graduate. Okay, that's one solution. But what happens then? What happens then is that those kids are not going to have high school diplomas. Even if they can't measure up in terms of academic scores, at least they have a high school diploma, which means at least they can maybe get a job and maybe feed themselves and maybe not be in the streets, etc. Because without a high school diploma, under these conditions of rapid, dynamic, profound gentrification and growing class and income polarization, a lot of these, especially African-American kids, are just going to be pushed into the streets. In other words, pushed into the pipeline to prison. And so the solution isn't to just stop them from graduating. The solution is, and it's not enough to punish teachers or to punish even administrators, that what's needed is to make sure that this city that says it speaks for the people in the nation's capital, in the richest country in the world, makes as its priority to make sure that working class people and poor communities and African-American communities have the kind of attention and resources that is required.
And it's offensive. The haves don't understand any of what you just said. They're never going to come out and change their PR approach at it. This quote from Ted Leonis, who owns the Washington Wizards, owns the Capitals, in regards to the topping ceremony that happened 2 weeks at St. Elizabeth's on the new stadium. He goes, "Today marks another important milestone as we prepare to open this first in the class facility for the Wizards, Mystics, and our new G League team, the Capital City Go-Go." If anybody can catch how offensive it is to name this basketball team the Capital City Go-Go. Leonis goes on to say, "Our commitment to Ward 8 community goes farther and deeper than the game of basketball. This project will have the capacity to transform a neighborhood and bolster the economy while also ensuring our coaches, athletes, and fans have the opportunity to teach, train, and cheer at one of the premier venues of its kind." I mean, talk about an out-of-touch billionaire who's about to get the city of Washington, D.C. to pay for his own stadium with schools that are failing less than a half a mile away from him. And he thinks he gets to be the credible voice on transforming the community and talking beyond. He's building a basketball stadium. This is about a basketball stadium for the man to have a larger TV buy share for more ads, for making more money for his development company. This is not about the community.
Bob Schley-Huber, we just have about 2 minutes left. I want to also ask you about another disturbing finding. Again, we're in the nation's capital right here, Washington, D.C. Study finds D.C. police using more force. The report that this is the differential between now, 2018 and 2013, the report found that up to 93% of use of force incidents in Washington, D.C. involved African-Americans, and that the three D.C. council wards with the highest reported crime, Ward 5, 7, and 8, accounted for nearly 40% of the use of force reports across the city. In other words, the police are using force. This is what they have to report now, by almost double. I mean, a 50% increase in the last 5 years. Now, the Washington Post says, well, maybe it's because video cameras are catching it. I don't think so. I think right now, as we see gentrification happening and this move to drive poor people and black people out of the city, of course, there's going to be over-policing and all of the attendant things that go with it, like police force.
Well, they keep on trying to address issues of poverty with policing, which is never going to be the solution. You're never going to find somebody a home by arresting them or finding them a proper meal or a proper job by arresting them. It's the sub-command stations 5 and 7 in Washington, D.C. that work within issues of poverty, and they don't know how to act except using force. It's to escalate force. It's to control people. That's all they're taught. That's all they know how to do. The body cameras pick up nothing but exactly what they're trained to do, and these officers aren't going to change their behavior. This report's not going to change their behavior. The video cameras aren't going to change their behavior. They're taught to use force, use excessive force, protect property at any cost. If the person doesn't have any of the resources, we don't know where they're at. We're there to punish and enforce the law. And as long as the city, the Antoine Wilsons, the Muriel Bowsers of the world do not take a social services approach, a public health approach, an actual human approach towards addressing these issues and continue to use police, we're going to continue to see these levels of violence.
Okay, we will leave it there. We were joined in the studio by Bob Schlehuber. Bob is a D.C. resident and the producer of Radio Sputnik's By Any Means Necessary, which you can listen to every weekday from 2 to 4 p.m. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Friday, John, which means that we're going to take a look at the media this week. We're going to keep our eye on the media, some of the worst and most misleading headlines or stories, and some that aren't the worst, but just bad.
Yes.
Just funny, maybe. We're joined by Steve Pat. Steve Pat, are you there?
I am.
Steve Pat is an independent journalist whose searing critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, which you can find at Left Eye, that's L-E-F-T-I, the letter I, .blogspot.com. Steve Pat, again, this week, third week in a row, you're suggesting some really, well, bad or stupid stories or stupid headlines. Let's talk about the one regarding Facebook. Facebook to rank news outlets by trustworthiness. That's a headline from CNN. Facebook to rank news outlets by trustworthiness. Not just the headline. The story itself is disturbing. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, first of all, it's disturbing in and of itself. I mean, we've seen what censorship has done on Google, for example, where we know that various progressive sites have almost disappeared from Google and Google News, thanks to their decision to do more or less the same thing. Facebook is pretending that they're being a little more open and surveying their users to determine this trust, so-called trustworthiness. But the first problem is their survey is just ludicrous. It only had two questions. They say in their blog post that they were trying to gauge users' familiarity with and trust in various different sources of news. But they don't actually judge their familiarity. Their question is, do you recognize this site? That's question one. And question two is, how trustworthy is it? So all you have to do is say you recognize RT or Sputnik or Counterpunch or something like that, and you're qualified to rate it as trustworthy or not trustworthy.
Oh, that's disgusting.
It can't possibly work.
And this is just so subjective.
Yeah, and then what happens if I say, yes, I recognize Fox News, and no, it is not trustworthy?
And what if I think Facebook or the owners of Facebook or the inner circle who plan the algorithms, what if I think they're not trustworthy?
They're not trustworthy.
And is that a category, Steve?
No. So, that's one problem, the idea that people are going to rate trustworthiness. And you know, for example, as John was just intimating, you know, all the Democrats and liberals are going to say Fox is untrustworthy, and all the 35% of America who thinks who are Trump supporters are going to say CNN and NBC and New York Times are untrustworthy. But if you read the CNN article, they say that they're going to use the scores from this survey along with other factors. So what does that mean? What it means is, and you know darn well what it means, is that even if CNN is rated untrustworthy by 35% of people and Fox is rated untrustworthy by 50% of people, they're not going to be downrated from Facebook. You know that very well. Who they're downrating is exactly the same people that Google downrated, which is progressive sites like Counterpunch and foreign sites like RT, Sputnik, Telesur, and so on. So it's really a scam or a sham that they're even pretending to do this.
Indeed. You have Donald Trump every day calling CNN fake news or some other MSNBC, and then the Republican and pro-Republican or the pro-Democratic or pro-liberal people say Fox News is untrustworthy. Then, of course, you mentioned the New York Times, which did convince a big part of the public, or at least we think they did, about the fact that Iraq really did have weapons of mass destruction, even though anybody paying attention would know that Iraq didn't have weapons of mass destruction. And certainly Iraq was surrounded and weakened and hobbled by 13 years of sanctions. But the other thing, John, is that this whole thing is, I don't know what's the right way to call it. I think the right way is calling it BS.
Yeah.
And you know what BS stands for?
Yes.
Bad sociology.
Yes, of course.
So this is bad sociology because Facebook came before the Congress, before congressional committees. So did Twitter. And they were basically asked, what did the Russians do to use Facebook and Twitter to interfere with and meddle in American politics? And Facebook and Twitter both said, we're not really aware of anything like that. And then they were beaten up. So then they came back and they said, oh, wait, we did find Russian meddling. The Russians bought $100,000 of Facebook ads. Turns out 56% of them were after the election. They weren't about any particular candidate. But nonetheless, they tried to assuage their critics in Congress. They wanted to go along with the witch hunt. And I think what this bad headline and bad story about trustworthiness is really about Facebook's sucking up to the Democrats and Republicans in Congress to show that they're on the team now. I think that's really what this is.
I think that's what it comes down to. Listen, just like you, Brian, I don't want the Russians meddling in my elections. I don't want the Israelis or the Chinese or the North Koreans or anybody else meddling in my elections.
I don't want Google or Facebook
to be meddling. But I don't want Google or Facebook meddling in my elections. And this is what this comes down to. It's Google and Facebook and others like them, Twitter, et cetera, who are going to tell us what they think we ought to know or tell us the extent of what we need to know.
And they
and
do
that's
it in secret.
Anti-democratic.
And they do it in secret. I mean,
indeed,
I think
do.
The U.S. Congress is not a democratic body. I mean, it's a talk shop.
Yeah.
But at least we know the names of the U.S. Congress. We don't
that's
know
right.
the names of the trustworthiness committee at Facebook.
No idea. They're accountable to no one but themselves.
Steve Pat, let's go on. We have 5 minutes left. Let's go to our next worst headline.
Okay, well, the next worst headline is just an amusing headline, but a not-so-amusing story. Hawaii's governor couldn't correct the false missile alert sooner because he forgot his Twitter password.
Oops.
I laughed out loud when I read that
one.
We
have an incoming. Oh, no, we don't. Wait, I can't. I mean, even though it's funny, people were saying their last goodbyes to their kids. I mean, this was a big deal in Hawaii. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, well, exactly. And the idea, first of all, that his best way to communicate with people in Hawaii was via Twitter is pretty funny. I mean, not everyone is following the Hawaii governor on Twitter to begin with, and not everyone is looking at their phone or their computer while they're busy kissing their loved ones goodbye or, you know, doing whatever they're doing in their 38 minutes of the last 38 minutes of life. So, I mean, they do actually have a way to reach everyone in Hawaii. That was the system that they used to let everyone know that there was a missile coming. So why doesn't he have their phone number? He couldn't call them up and say, hey, please send out another alert to everyone so I don't have to try to alert them by Twitter.
Yeah. So and also, if you're in your bunker already, you might not have as good reception to get Twitter to get the message from the governor.
Right.
But again, you know, there's another part to the story. Each of these stories you can ridicule and they're humorous. They're tragic. But underneath it, there's something very serious, which is it shows how feeble and fragile, because human beings are fragile and society is fragile. We are in the face of what could be catastrophic events, including nuclear events. In other words, the possibility of a mistake. You know, we've had experts, including Daniel Ellsberg and Greg Mello, Kevin Camps on this show. There's a lot of near misses. And here you have the governor of Hawaii trying to communicate with the people in Hawaii who think they're about to be obliterated and say, don't worry, you can't, but I can't find my password.
You know, and this isn't governor supposed to have the same kind of authority that any other governor has to issue the equivalent of an Amber Alert, right? Something that goes to every cell phone in the entire state of Hawaii. But he didn't do that. He went looking for his Twitter password.
We have about 2.5 minutes, Steve. I want to go to another headline. This one, I think, is from RT, and it's not really about the headline. It's more about the story. Go ahead.
Well, this headline, which just came out today, based on an interview that the British defense secretary did with the Telegraph newspaper, the headline reads, U.S. defense secretary drops latest fear bomb, casually warns Russia is planning mass murder. And here's the money quote from the article. Again, this is the British defense secretary. It says that Russia is looking at doing the following: damage the economy, rip Britain's infrastructure apart, actually cause thousands and thousands and thousands of deaths. This is very serious warning.
Well, the RT article says, why stop there? Why not millions of deaths or trillions or gazillions? Like, let's go for it.
Exactly. And of course, as the article also says, all they really need to do to cause lots of deaths is to contribute to the Tory reelection fund, because it's the Tories, just like the Republicans here, are trying to rip up the National Health Service and deny people health care, which is exactly going to cause thousands and thousands of thousands of deaths, as it is already in the United States, where people die, 30 or 40,000 people die every year due to lack of health care. So the idea that Russia is planning to do this is, there's no evidence for this, of course. It's just fear-mongering, as the article says.
Okay, we have about a minute left. I see Elon Musk is on your headline list. What's that all about? Elon Musk's all or nothing bet on Tesla. That sounds dramatic. All or nothing?
Yeah, this was a headline, and we're supposed to feel very sad for Elon Musk, because if Tesla doesn't do as well as he hopes it's going to do, he'll get nothing for 10 years of hard work.
Poor Elon.
He'll have nothing to show for it.
No.
How's he going to feed those 5 children he has?
Yeah, they don't mention in the headline, of course, although you can find out that Elon is currently worth, that's in quotes, $20 billion, billion with a B. That's on top of the $37,000 he's guaranteed, because that's the California minimum wage, apparently, for his...
So he gets a minimum wage on top of his $20 billion in assets.
Exactly.
But he's going to bet everything, meaning he won't get paid at all over the next period unless he hits the goals. I mean...
Yeah.
Elon Musk is, among all things, I would say, mostly a showman. This is really just designed to get more headlines for Elon Musk. I'm risking it all, except not the $20 billion.
Right, exactly. If he was putting up his $20 billion, that'd be a different story. Then it really would be an all-or-nothing bet. But that's not happening.
That's it. We've been joined from San Francisco by Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist. His searing critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, which you can find at Left Eye, that's LEFTI, the letter I, .blogspot.com. We'll be back on Monday. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area, you can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and at 1390 AM. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com. And you can hear us as an iTunes podcast or at Spreaker. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and clear.